The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Victoria Brownlee. Victoria is currently the Ireland Programme Manager for Athena Swan, which is a project we'll be chatting to her about shortly. And we're delighted to Victoria today to talk about her new book, Biblical Readings and Literary Writings in Early Modern England, 1558 to 1625, just published by Oxford University Press. Victoria, congratulations on the book, and thanks for coming on to the show.
Thanks for having me, Crawford. It's lovely to be here.
It's great to have you here. So, before we begin talking about this book, which is a tremendous book, can you tell us something about yourself?
So, Crawford, you mentioned that I manage the Athena Swan programme in Ireland, which is a gender equality charter for higher education. And that's what I've been doing for the last 5 months. Before that, I worked as a lecturer in English, 16th and 17th century, in NUI Galway in Ireland.
Very good. Now, this book, as you acknowledge at the very beginning, is based on your PhD thesis, which you did that very estimable university, Queen's University Belfast. It's amazing for anyone to get their first book published with Oxford. Can you just tell us how you did that?
Well, Crawford, it was a long road. I think getting any book into print is difficult, especially one that begins as a PhD project, because I think a PhD project's a great foundation for a book, but it's also not a book. So getting to the end of the PhD was one thing, but I got fantastic advice during my viva and from my supervisor as to, I suppose, how best to disseminate the research in the PhD. I was very fortunate to get Irish Research Council postdoc fellowship 2 years after I finished my PhD. And I think that was really foundational to getting the book together. I suppose taking it from a PhD thesis and into a book. And there's quite a bit of new research and new writing. I had a great mentor at UCD where I had that postdoc. So I think I'd lots of good advisors along the way. And then patience. Oxford, I knew, would be a good publisher somewhere I'd like to be published. I contacted them. They were interested. There was lots of back and forwards, lots of readings and rereadings and changing. So I would say patience having good advisors was how I got the book into print.
Well, it certainly paid off in the end. It's a really tremendous piece of work. And in fact, as I was just saying to you before we went on to air, it's a book we're going to be using for teaching purposes next year. It's a great book for undergraduates and postgraduates as well as academics to engage with. Before we begin talking about the content of the book, could you tell us about the structure?
Yes. So the book has an introductory chapter as well as a preface. And I suppose the work of the preface is to say, what is this book about and how does it relate to other scholarship that's in the sphere of early modern studies on early modern religion, on the Bible and literature, and on post-Reformation history. So that's kind of the work of the preface. The introduction, the introductory chapter then, I suppose, guides the reader through what kind of society I'm talking about, the sort of access to the Bible, the influence of the Bible in society, which is very different to today, the way people read the Bible. But then the subsequent chapters are all hung around a popularly interpreted biblical narrative in the 16th and 17th centuries. And the reason I chose to structure the book in that way was I wanted to highlight the variety of ways that the Bible was used in the period. That if you wanted to know how to treat your king, you read the Bible in the 16th and 17th century. Attitudes towards women, towards motherhood and childbirth were very much rooted in the Bible. But the Bible also was a means of debating the capabilities and limitations of language. So I suppose the reason to structure around individual biblical narratives was to highlight that there wasn't a uniform way of reading the Bible in the period, but it really was incredibly diverse.
Oh, sounds like the kind of thing could help us with Brexit. But if we go to your title, you use the term biblical readings in your title. What Bibles are being read in this period? Which Bibles in particular are you most interested in?
Well, probably for the time frame of my book, which is the mid-16th century into the early part of the 17th century, the Geneva Bible was most influential and most popularly read. It was accessible, lots of copies being printed in England in that period. But also the authorized version, or what's sometimes known as the King James Bible, published in 1611. So my book looks at both of those Bibles and engagement with those versions as well as others.
One of the things I really enjoyed about the introduction to your book is the way in which you show that the literary culture, which we often think of as very logocentric, is much more than that. That the experience of reading the Bible is an experience of reading an illustrated text. But why is that significant in your reading of these readings?
Well, I think the Bible circulated in lots of different ways in this period. And, you know, as modern readers, we think of physically reading, sitting down to read a copy of the Bible. But the reality was in the 16th and 17th century, literacy levels aren't what they are today. And many people engaged with the Bible either audibly, hearing it, being read aloud in the home, in sermons, but also visually in the theatre where biblical narratives were popularly played, or through ballads and songs, and also in stained glass representations of biblical stories, or in images that appeared in cheap print. And so the Bible really was everywhere in 16th and 17th century society. And that's something that's very difficult for us as modern readers to get to grips with.
Can you tell us a little bit about your date range, Victoria, 1558 to 1625? Why did you choose that particular chronological frame?
Well, I wanted the reader or the potential reader to know immediately the kind of focus of the book. So I decided to tie it to the late Tudor period and early Stuart. So 1625, the death of James I. So I wanted to tie it to those reigns because those were most central to the literature that I was focusing on. But I do explain in the preface that because I think about the relationship between literature and the aftermath of the Reformation or the religious changes of the 16th century, that I talk about earlier biblical texts in terms of exegesis and sermons, and also later texts as well, to try and give a flavour of what was happening before and after the literature that I consider.
So, Victoria, if, as you just mentioned, literacy levels are very low, if only a few people could read proportionally to the population at large, why were books important, and specifically, why was the Bible such an important book?
I think the Bible was important because people believed it to be the authoritative word of God. And certainly for Protestants, the physical, you know, book and the words of the Bible were central because they were moving away from an understanding of faith that was connected to history of the church and church pronouncements, to saying, no, the words as we have them in the Bible are really the only way that we can understand our relationship with God, but also our day-to-day lives.
So that being the case, given that literacy levels were so low, how did people engage with this sacred book? Did they read the Bible passively or actively, individually in groups, devotionally, intellectually? Are there any examples of particularly interesting active reading that you could point us to?
Well, I think there's two different ways of experiencing the Bible in this period. For those who couldn't read, it may have been someone read to you aloud through your attendance at church, through hearing public preaching, which was considered to be a form of entertainment in the period, going to plays and so on. But if you could read, I think reading the Bible was both an individual activity and one that happened as part of a larger community. So certainly in Protestant culture at the time, individuals were encouraged to engage with their Bible devotionally, and that devotional reading would be active. So pen in hand, writing out portions of the Bible, annotating the biblical text. There were memory aids to assist people in retaining huge swathes of biblical text. And so it was really allowing the words of the Bible to shape one's kind of heart. The term fashion, the heart, was used quite a lot in the period to describe devotional writing and devotional reading and the writing that was connected. I would think as well that in terms of reading the Bible in community, that's important in ascertaining, well, who has the authority to say what the Bible means. So while Protestantism encouraged individuals to read the Bible, they wanted that biblical reading to take place within the framework of catechism and the sermons of the church, which would guide understanding, as opposed to individuals just deciding for themselves what the words meant.
Okay, that's helpful. So the experience of Bible reading is a community experience for many, if not most, Bible readers. But yet it's also actively individual, isn't it, in this period?
Yeah.
And you give us some lovely examples here of advice literature, I suppose you could call it, books published to explain how to read the Bible, when to read the Bible, as you just mentioned, strategies for memorization. How much of the Bible were people reading, and when were they reading it?
Well, that depends on what advice they were receiving and which guidebooks they were reading on how the Bible should be read. And you're right, there are many different examples in the opening chapter of the book. Most guides during this period encouraged sequential reading. So that is reading the Bible from the Old Testament to the New Testament in order to understand the kind of Christological narrative that the Old Testament was pointing towards the coming of Christ as described in the New Testament. That's not to say that that people always read the Bible that way, and cross-referencing and cross-reading is very much encouraged. So if you pick up a copy of the of a Geneva Bible in this period, you'll see that the Geneva text has lots of cross-references. And so if you're reading Isaiah, it will point you to portions of the Gospels that Isaiah may be referencing. So while people might have been reading through the Bible, they will also have been flicking across different books and both Testaments as part of their reading. There's also some evidence that people use the liturgical calendar, the Book of Common Prayer, to structure their reading. Some guidebooks in this period advise people to read a chapter of the Old Testament, a chapter of the New Testament, and a chapter of the Psalms. Certainly scholars who've worked on Psalm reading in the period have shown that was a really central book for biblical readers.
Fascinating. Now, your own book here that we're talking about today is, I suppose, an example of doing exactly this, isn't it? It's structured consecutively from Old to New Testament, but each chapter also shows us how passages can be read through Scripture typologically, as we'll see in a moment, as we'll think about in a moment. But I suppose one of the obvious questions to follow on from what you've just said is a question about hermeneutics. So if Bible readers are reading through the Bible, but also across the Bible, as you just emphasised, are they reading this text literally? If they're trying to spot connections between, as you just said, Isaiah and the Gospels or other Old Testament narratives and other aspects of New Testament doctrine, for example, are they always reading according to the literal sense?
Well, that's a great question, Crawford. And it's something I was really interested in the book, because when I started to think about Protestants reading the Bible, I had the mantra of Protestantism, which is there's only one literal sense. There's only one sense, and that is the literal sense, which is kind of the common Protestant mantra in this period. And initially, when I started the research, I thought that meant, well, Protestants were committed to what we would define as a literal reading of the Bible. But actually, how Protestants defined literalism was quite different. Protestant literalism could encompass typology, sometimes allegory, And that really was necessary when we think how the Bible itself is written, because the Bible uses similes and metaphors, and parables are used to teach in the New Testament. A book like Revelation is described as a prophecy, and then we've got the Song of Songs, which I imagine we'll talk about in a minute. In order to get to grips with the different writing styles in the Bible, Protestants had to argue for a literal sense that was quite flexible. And I think it's John Donne who says that the literal sense ultimately is the intention of the Holy Spirit. So it's very broad how many Protestants are defining the literal sense.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, it's striking, isn't it, when you come to a passage like Galatians 4, in which Paul says this is an allegory. how early modern commentators really work hard to try and work out what that means, how you can read an allegory in a literal way. And of course, that's missing the point. It's a massive subject you're talking about here, Victoria, the Bible and early modern literature. And obviously you're writing about this not just as an historian, as we've just been thinking about historical context and social significance and practice and so forth, but you're also writing as a literary critic. How have other literary critics thought generally about the significance of the Bible in this period?
Well, in the last probably 20 years especially, there's been a huge surge of interest in the relationship between early modern literature and the Bible. There's been a fantastic range of studies. Unsurprisingly, many of those have focused on Shakespeare, everything from biblical references in Shakespeare to allusions that might be in the language of Shakespeare's plays and poems. So a lot of the work has probably been author focused, Shakespeare, Milton, Mary Sidney, but there's also been work that's thought about genres, so in relation to poetry, and there's been work on biblical women as well, thinking about their influence on drama and in other texts. So I suppose my book very much is building on that range of scholarship that's emerged, but it's trying to draw, different genres together within the various chapters. So I look at drama and poetry. I look at a variety of writers. But then there's also some consideration of visual media in the period, like stained glass, woodcuts, and so on, in order to think about how the drama of the period, the poetry of the period, is operating within this huge kind of biblically saturated culture.
It's fascinating, as you tell us there, that there has been a surge of interest in the last 20 years in biblical references in early modern writing. And yet you say somewhere in the book that there still exists a large body of biblical poetry that's never really been explored.
Yes, that's right. And I look at a couple of examples of that poetry, someone like William Baldwin, Francis Quarles. They're writers that were hugely popular in the period, but haven't received an awful lot of critical attention. Despite the growing interest in the relationship between literature and the Bible in early modern studies, biblical verse paraphrase was immensely popular in the 16th and 17th centuries, an alternative way of getting to grips with the Bible's content. But it's also part of that active reading strategy that that I mentioned earlier, some individuals writing poetry as part of their devotional reading of the Bible. And I think it's really important that we do think about the work that's been done in relation to biblical verse paraphrase in this period, because if we exclude it, we're excluding lots of writing by women, lots of writing by lay men as well. And I think it's potentially a really rich avenue for study.
Another thing that really struck me as being important about your book is its emphasis upon biblical drama, something that historians of the Reformation are sometimes a bit nervous to approach, but we deal with it in quite considerable detail here.
Yes, so the history of biblical drama is a long one. Biblical drama was used prior to the Reformation, medieval mystery cycles, and so on, in order to teach seminal passages of the Bible. That continues after the Reformation. It changes, but it does continue. And so the reformers are really drawing on an older tradition of using plays to teach the Bible. What we begin to see in the later half of the 16th century is that drama very much not being a straightforward repetition of biblical narrative, but really a forum in which you can debate doctrine, alternative interpretations of the Bible, and even comment on the politics of the 16th and 17th century.
So when we think about Puritanism and its rejection of the stage or its hostility to the stage, and as we think about Shakespeare's Malvolio or Ben Jonson's Zeal of the Land Busy, we're looking at a much later relationship between Reformation and the stage than the kinds of things you speak about in this book, aren't we?
Yes, absolutely. I think in the 17th century, the attitudes towards the stage shift among Puritans, as you mentioned. But in the first decade of the 17th century, there's a flurry of biblical plays. And we can assume, many of them are now lost, but we can assume that those plays were performed because there was a demand among audiences and a willingness among dramatists to produce that content. But you're quite right, by the time we get to 1620 and later, those kinds of plays aren't popping up on the register of plays in the period.
So Victoria, one of the first and most important case studies you give us in the book is a study of how the character of Solomon was read in early modern literature. Really interesting case study, because Solomon in the Old Testament, in Kings and Chronicles, is such an equivocal figure. He's the greatest of Israel's kings, but he's also the king who introduces idolatry, has what, 300 wives, 700 concubines, something like that. A very equivocal figure, perhaps, to represent the Tudor or Stuart monarchs in association with. Why were early modern writers drawn to Solomon? What could Solomon do for them?
Well, I think early modern writers were interested in Israelite history generally. That's the first thing to say. They were fascinated with the relationship between Israel and England. And some of that was the result of perhaps a distancing, particularly among Protestants, from church history as conceived by the Catholic Church, and a desire to point to an alternative Protestant history and draw out a connection between kind of triumphant English history as they would see it and triumphant English Protestantism and the triumphs of Israel. And so Solomon, as you mentioned, famous Old Testament king, famous particularly for his wisdom and his wealth and his authority. And one can see many successes in Solomon's reign. And I think that was the initial attraction for early modern monarchs who wanted to identify with Solomon and other Israelite kings. They wanted to be seen as wise like Solomon, rich like Solomon, and to have dominion like Solomon had over his territories. I think one of the difficulties of that was that Solomon was not the kind of exemplary king that many early modern writers and kings would have liked him to be. And there is, as you mentioned in your question, that whole end section to Solomon's narrative in Kings that points to the fact that, you know, he was disobedient ultimately to God in his choice of wives and in the introduction of idols. So I think one of the challenges for early modern writers was identifying with Solomon selectively. So that's something I look at in this chapter, just how selectively Solomon is read in order to kind of boost Tudor and Stuart ideas of kingship. So we have lots of popular identification of Henry VIII and of James I with Solomon, but also interestingly of Elizabeth with Solomon. And all of that requires this immensely selective reading of his text. And there's some good examples of that. So John Williams, in his funeral sermon to James I, talks about how James can be compared to Solomon in all of his virtues, and only fleetingly acknowledges that Solomon had some, some negative points, but none of these are relevant to King James. And one of the things I look at in the book at is the fact that that's quite difficult to do in a culture where people were reading the Bible and would have been aware of the whole narrative. And I think that becomes more problematic when you see Solomon identified with monarchs in drama, because drama is fluid and flexible and shows kind of narrative progression. The Westminster Boys School in 1565 performed a play about Solomon's reign in front of Elizabeth, when Princess Cecilia of Sweden was visiting. And the play was written by German dramatists, but adapted very much to pay homage to Elizabeth and all of her graces and her authority. So it identifies Elizabeth with Solomon and Cecilia with the Queen of Sheba. And it goes through the building of the temple and the examples of Solomon's wisdom and so on. But there are these moments where we see the kind of darker, more problematic elements of Solomon's narrative bleeding through the drama. And I think those moments really highlight the complexity of identifying with any biblical figure, not least an Old Testament king.
Well, we get traces of Solomon in one of your other case studies, which is the early modern reading of the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs, or Canticles. And I suppose here in this chapter, you show very clearly how lots of early modern Protestants in particular went to great lengths not to read the text literally. So what for them did the Song of Songs mean if it wasn't an actual account of an actual love affair? What was the text about and what was the text for?
Well, I think for most people in this period, the Song of Songs or the Canticles described the relationship between Christ and the church. And that interpretation was argued for on the basis of the kind of cross-reading that I mentioned earlier. So the New Testament epistles which talk about Christ's love for the church, and that's kind of read back onto the relationship that's described in Solomon. The problem with that reading for early modern commentators is that they have to work quite hard to I suppose, prove to their readers that this is really what's intended by this biblical book, and to offset some of the sensual imagery in that book. And there's lots of concern in this period about how the lay reader might be distracted by the erotic imagery in the Song of Songs. And What's interesting is that perhaps one of the most poetic books of the Bible produces the most lumpen commentary. Certainly, commentary in Song of Songs is incredibly dense in this period, and often incredibly dull. And it's like commentators want to use more and more words to take the reader away from that sensual imagery, which they fear is a distraction to the reader's devotion.
Well, you continue this fascinating discussion of gender in your chapter on Mary and birth in women's writing in the 17th century in particular. Fascinating chapter. Do you think, Victoria, we still need to advocate for the study of women's writing in early modern studies?
Well, I think in an ideal world, women's writing would be read alongside men's writing, and we'd be studying early modern writing that interests us. The reality is that for many years, early modern women's writing was neglected. And I think that there's value to studying women's writing specifically in order to raise awareness of the kinds of texts that women were reading and the kinds of texts that women were writing. So I think there's very much kind of virtue in studying women's writing. And of course, women in this period faced some restrictions in terms of what they could write and what they could read, which also makes it appropriate to study on its own.
Do you think Bible reading gave women an opportunity for a voice in this period?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think many women find a voice and find a writing voice and a very brave one, as the examples I use in this chapter suggest. I suppose the Bible legitimized women having the right to speak up on particular issues because of the general encouragement that every individual should read the Bible for their own edification. And I think that what's fascinating when you look at what women were writing in this period is the complexity of their work on biblical texts. So in this chapter, I look at Amelia Lanier and Dorothy Lee, both of whom use typology extensively, showing not only that women, like men, read the Bible, not only that women, like men, wrote about the Bible, but also women, like men, interpreted the Bible in this period. Mm.
Well, Victoria, that's a perfect way for us to come to the conclusion of our chat today. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and talk about this magnificent new book, Biblical Readings and Literary Writings in Early Modern England, 1558 to 1625, just published by Oxford. So thanks for sharing this work with us. But before you go, can you tell us a little bit more about your current work with Athena Swan?
So, as I mentioned, I manage the Athena Swan programme in Ireland, and that's a charter which universities and institutes of technology can sign up to and as a means of improving gender equality in their institutions, improving the representation of women and men in subjects where they might be underrepresented. So I go out, meet institutions, talk to them about the application process and offer training and support. So I'm not doing research at the moment, but I do hope to do some work in the next little while on 17th century prophetesses and their readings of the Bible.
Wonderful. Well, it's a great role and it's a great project. You've given us some time now to read before your next project comes out, Biblical Readings and Literary Writings in Early Modern England, 1558 to 1625. Thank you, Victoria. And thanks to all of you for listening today. I'll see you next time here on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. Thank you and goodbye.